He's the author of 15 books, including most recently last year's To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia, and this year's The Terrorism Trap, September 11th and Beyond. He informs me that he has a new book coming out next year that is The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. A number of us are familiar with Michael's writings and his talks from alternative media sources such as Co-op Radio, People's Voice, Zed Magazine, Covert Action, Global Outlook, and a number of other magazines and periodicals. He's appeared on radio and television talk shows to discuss current issues. He lectures on college campuses and wide range of audiences across North America and abroad. Tomorrow, if those of you that can't get enough of him, you can travel with him to Kelowna, where he's going to be speaking in Kelowna. At the bookstore, when customers come, the things they say about Michael Parenti and why they like to buy his books and read his writings and listen to his talks on the radio and come to hear him when he comes to town are that he's an impassionate speaker. He's not distant and aloof, but passionate. His writings are accessible, not difficult to understand like so many of our political analysts, but actually accessible, written in a form that most people can get and understand. His arguments are cogent and compelling. He's inspirational. He does not leave us paralyzed with cynicism and distrust, but instead inspires us to believe that we can build a better world. With no further time wasted, I'd like to introduce Michael Parenti.
Thank you. Thank you. The topic for tonight is, I think it's Terrorism, Globalization, and Conspiracy. Was that the title? Am I in the right town, right title? I'd like to start with the most important of those three. This is a trick stand here. Here we go. Most important of those three, which is globalization. Globalization is an attempt to extend corporate monopoly control over the entire globe, over every national economy, over every local economy, over every life. It does this by treating international corporate property rights and international corporate investment rights as supreme, as taking precedence over all other rights, including our democratic sovereignty. You know, globalization has been treated by its proponents as a natural, inevitable process. First, we had local economies, then they naturally became regional economies, and then national, and then international, and now one big global economy. It just happens that way. In fact, there's nothing inevitable about it, and there's certainly nothing natural about it. Globalization is being forced upon us through a series of secretive international trade agreements. Globalization really, when you look at it historically in a centuries-old context, is a future variant of imperialism. Imperialism is that system in which the leading dominant elements in one country expropriate the land, the labor, the resources, the capital of other peoples and other countries. And imperialism itself is an expansionist form of capitalism. Now, I want to make some critical comments about capitalism, even though we're in a Presbyterian church. I just think. Any mention of capitalism immediately evokes or induces some people to lapse into sentimentality and bathos. All our lives, we've heard about the valiant little entrepreneur who markets a new idea, who creates jobs. It's usually given in that kind of sentimental sing-song voice. Performs a valuable service. The mom-and-pop stores that contribute to the community and the economy. Okay, I'm not talking about them, okay? I'm talking about the other 90% of the wealth in this world. I'm talking about the giant financial institutions, the giant transnational corporations that control the lion's share of the world's worth, that control the populations and the power of nations. You can't talk about globalization and imperialism without talking about capitalism, although some people manage to do it and try to do that all the time. We're taught a few things about capitalism. We're taught that it's a system that works. It's a system that has brought us prosperity. We've heard that all our lives. Now, I'm going to try to convince you otherwise, and I'm going to do it in 2 minutes. Okay? Actually, I think some of you already have certain suspicions about that system. It's very simple. Almost the entire world is capitalist. And almost the entire world is poor. Capitalist Indonesia is miserably poor and getting poorer. Capitalist India is miserably poor and getting poorer. So with capitalist Thailand and capitalist Nigeria and capitalist El Salvador and Haiti and Mexico and Brazil and Argentina. And capitalist Russia and Poland and Bulgaria, with all the privatization and deregulation and free market coming in. Poverty, poverty, increase in crime, increase in desperation, increase in misery, increase in homelessness, increase in suicides. It's capitalism at work, moving in. Now, not everyone suffers. The capitalists in these countries are doing quite well. These countries are getting poorer as the giant corporations move in and get richer. These companies are getting poorer as there's more and more deregulation, more and more so-called free market, which is really monopoly market. It's a free market if you've got money. It's a market that works for those who have money. These countries are getting poorer because the people are being driven off the lands by the giant corporations. They create business zones. You can go to places, islands in the Philippines, where people have had beautiful communities for since time immemorial. They fish. They have their houses in the community. They have their orchards. They have their vineyards and whatever, the farms. And the giant companies come in with some bogus claim to the land, drive them all off it, and clear cut the wood that's on there and turn it into a wasteland, since it's tropical topsoil. It can't survive clear cutting. And these people are driven off into the shanty towns. And you get a record. In the Philippines, the gross national product has gone up because this company has come in and made all these sales on the timber. Meanwhile, thousands and thousands of lives are utterly destroyed. And the people go into the cities and they find new work opportunities under the free market capitalism. Prostitution and drugs and beggary. All sorts of new things that didn't exist in their lives before. So those business zones make people poorer. The corporations go in and they displace and they wipe out domestic production and domestic businesses by dumping and underselling. That makes people poorer. The corporations go in, they force cutbacks in human services, education, health, and housing as the country develops a heavier and heavier debt structure, as the IMF does its structural adjustment programs, imposing conditions of lowered spending and lowered consumption. They consume less, they've got to produce more to help pay this debt, a debt that becomes soon unpayable because it accumulates and compounds. That makes people poorer. The corporation forced down prices of non-renewable resources, go in and plunder the land, the earth, to get those natural resources out, underpaying whatever production the people do produce and whatever they put on the international market is underpaid through monopoly control of those markets. That makes people poorer. So we've solved the mystery. Look, I did it in a little bit more than 2 minutes. We've solved the mystery, though, why over the past half century financial investment has increased, profits have increased, wealth has increased, but so has poverty. Because wealth and poverty don't just live together in unfortunate juxtaposition. We always hear that too, don't we? Isn't it terrible? So much wealth next to so much poverty. What a shame. Wouldn't it be nice if these people gave a little bit more to these people? Well, they're not just there so much shamefully in contrast. They're there in a dynamic interrelationship because it's wealth that creates poverty. The corporations don't go into the third world to start affirmative action programs to abolish poverty, to uplift these little brown and black and yellow people to the ways of the wise white man. They don't go in to do that, or they actually talk about doing that. They don't go in to help the poor, they go in to help themselves. And that's what they do. Well, okay, Parenti, capitalism doesn't work so well for the common people in those third world countries, but it has given us a good standard of living. Let's now look at that. Will you give me 3 minutes to disabuse you of that myth that some of you, I won't ask for a show of hands, but some of you have held all your life? Let's look at our own North American society. Let's put aside the massive inequalities. Let's put aside the tens of millions who struggle from hand to mouth. Let's put aside the many who call themselves middle class but who live without any real economic security. Let's put aside the desperate ones at the very bottom. Let's put aside the attacks and impoverishment on the public sector and the destruction of a livable environment. Let's just put all that aside for a minute, those little things. And let's accept the idea that we live in great material abundance, and compared to much of the world, we do. Many of us in Canada and the United States live very well indeed. That's why the victims of capitalism, we always hear about the victims of communism wanting to flee communism. Nothing's ever been said about the victims of capitalism. I come from a family of victims of capitalism. My grandparents, both families, came from southern Italy, grinding terrible poverty. They were victims of capitalism. They came over here to be victims of capitalism again, but a little less so. And that's what happens. So let's accept this idea of great material abundance. But it wasn't capitalism that gave us a good standard of living. It was the democratic struggle against corporate capitalism that did it. I mean, why don't Canadians work for 15 cents an hour as people in Haiti and Indonesia do? Is it because you're just so much more self-respecting, you just wouldn't do that? Or is it because you're at a level of democratic class struggle, a historical level that has advanced to a more favorable level? You know, North Americans used to work for starvation and subsistence wages. In 1900, Canada and the United States and the Netherlands and Denmark and France And other countries that are today considered very prosperous capitalist countries, Western industrial countries, they don't want to use the word capitalism as much. They just don't want you to think about capitalism. They were all third world nations almost a half a century before the term was invented. Child labor was widespread. Poverty was widespread. Unemployment, underemployment, 14-hour workdays, no social services to speak of except an occasional church or charity. No social benefits, typhoid epidemics in Philadelphia and Baltimore, tuberculosis, other diseases of poverty, no public housing or public health services to speak of, very little public education, no public libraries, hardly. Advances came not with capitalism. Capitalism was reigning. Capitalism, the capitalist class, the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rockefellers, the Harringtons, all these people, they were making it in here. Advances came when we made certain democratic victories. The 8-hour day, the end of child labor, worker safety, the right to labor unions and the collective bargaining, public health programs, disability insurance, old age pensions. These are things that we have been fighting for, still inadequate, still insufficient, still not universal, and yet these things, as incomplete as they are, they are still under siege by the same people who fought against those things. It wasn't capitalism that brought these advances, it was democracy. It was the people acting as the active social agents of their own lives, fighting and struggling for those things. And the capitalists, the rich bankers, the merchant class, the corporate class, the slaveholders, they all fought against democracy. They fought against political democracy as well as economic democracy. In the United States, that class fought against the elimination of property qualifications for voters and office holders. They fought against universal suffrage for working men. They fought against suffrage for women. They fought against the abolition of slavery and Jim Crow. They fought against honest elections, and they're still doing a very good job of that in Florida. They fought against democratic ballot access. They fought against proportional representation, campaign finance reform, civil liberties, and they're still fighting against these things. They're fighting against every bit of political democracy and every bit of economic democracy that benefits the people. So why do you credit the capitalists with the gains that you made against the capitalists? Why do you credit the people who fought tooth and nail and claw and fang against every one of these things, who are still fighting, who are still rolling it back, doing it right here in British Columbia, as you know, fighting against, trying to degrade our standard of living? Every democratic victory we've made is under siege, continually fighting to drag us back to 1900. Why do we credit them with giving us a good standard of living? If they had their way, our kids would be working in those factories 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. Credit yourselves, brothers and sisters. So when we say that capitalism works or doesn't work, we must specify for whom. In one important sense, it's incorrect to say that capitalism doesn't work well in third world nations. For the capitalist, it works much better in Indonesia than it does in Denmark. The rate of profit and capital accumulation per dollar invested in Indonesia is 4, 5, 6, 10 times higher than it is in Denmark. Obviously, if you can pay people 15 cents an hour, 12 cents an hour, instead of having to pay them, as in Denmark with benefits and all that, many, many dollars an hour, you're going to be making much more money. The public sector is smaller. Regulations are less or non-existent or very poorly enforced than they are in, say, the Western European or North American countries. Their goal is the third worldization of everywhere. That's the goal of finance, international finance, corporate capitalism. the third worldization of everywhere. Their goal is to get us back to 1900. I as a corporate capitalist, every dollar I've got to spend on stupid, annoying, frivolous, unnecessary things like wages and health insurance and pensions and occupational safety and environmental protection. Every dollar I've got to spend on something idiotic like that is one less dollar for me. When will it stop? When will my oppression stop? Now you want seniority rights. Now you want collective bargaining. Now you want vacations. Now you want paid vacations. When will this stop until you drag me into total poverty, until I have nothing left on my estates? Okay. So capitalism worked much better. Capitalism worked much better for the capitalists in the United States and Canada in 1902 than in 2002. And that's why they're trying to get us back there. Okay. Now, the people of the world don't necessarily take this expropriation of their land, their labor, their markets, their natural resources. They don't take it with a happy smile. They're often represented that way, as smiling and just playing music a lot. But they fight back. They organize. For centuries, they have been fighting against this imperial colonial expropriation. And for centuries, the European powers have been murdering them and killing them and using state-sponsored terrorism. For centuries, the European powers, and then later on, the North American powers and Japan, went in there and expropriated the land, the labor, the natural resources of Asia, Africa, Latin America. And they went in there because those countries were not poor, they were rich. You don't go to poor countries to make money. You go to rich countries. They went in there for the hemp, the flax, the cotton, the copper, the coffee, the iron, the diamonds, the gold, the oil, the oil, the oil. Can I say that three times? They were rich countries, and they still are, many of them, rich countries. Only the people are poor. The countries are rich. And you look then at the Middle East, and you see this terrorism emerging, it's called. Well, these countries have been the object of state-sponsored terrorism for generations. And the global system of U.S. global imperialism has destroyed democratic and popular reform movements in Pakistan, in Turkey, in Syria, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in Yemen, in Iran, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan. Popular democratic movements in country after country destroyed. And so what do the young people have left? People who look and see their societies being destroyed, their cultures being undermined, they move toward a religious totality. They move toward an apocalyptic confrontation. They decide they must attack the demon who's doing this. Lacking a class analysis, they think in terms of national units. It's not the United States, it's not the Americans who are doing this to them. It's the ruling interests in America who are doing this to them, and they're doing it also to us Americans back in the States, I can tell you. Let's look at Afghanistan. Well, the U.S. has convinced the U.S. public that Afghanistan was a war to stop Soviet aggression. In fact, the Afghan government was a left military government that took over against a rightist government that was purging the left. And then it found itself under siege from Pakistan, from surrogate forces from Pakistan and from the CIA, and moved into Afghanistan. That government was targeted. That government was doing unacceptable things. That government was doing what the Torrijos government in Panama had been doing, what the New Jewel government in Grenada had been doing, what the Sandinista government in Nicaragua had been doing, what today the Hugo Chavez government in Venezuela is trying to do. That government was indulging in land reform, putting in minimum wage laws, legalized labor unions in Afghanistan, put up public education programs for boys and girls, which was an unusual thing, and the like. That was the Soviet-supported government. The Soviets came in after repeated requests by that left military, and then came this very ugly war. That government was doing what the United States leaders will not tolerate anywhere. They will not tolerate any government in the world that is attempting an alternative system outside of the globalization process, outside of that system of U.S. multinational, transnational, global finance capitalism. Outside, even another capitalist country that's trying economic nationalism and developing itself on its own terms, even that will no longer be tolerated. That was tolerated when there was a Soviet Union. That was tolerated. When there was a Soviet Union, Yugoslavia was tolerated. It was a country that was a buffer against the Soviets. It was independent of the Soviets, often critical of them, but it also was socialist. With the overthrow of the Soviet Union, the ruling interests in Western capitalism have come to certain realizations. We don't have to make any kind of social contract with our own working class anymore. We don't have to turn to you and say, you see how much better you live than the people over in Russia? We don't have to say that anymore. We won. We're rolling back in Russia. In fact, after the overthrow of the Soviet Union, there was a very querulous note that began to appear in many right-wing publications. It went as follows. If now in the former communist countries we're having total free market deregulation and takeover and privatization, why must we still tolerate here in our own countries, why must we still tolerate social programs and public ownership and regulation and the like? We don't have to tolerate that anymore. And you workers, you can forget about lifelong seniority or job security, whatever else. You've got nowhere else to go. You can go turn any color you want, red, pink, whatever else, but there's no Soviet menace anymore there. You don't have a base. You don't have a global base anymore. And they could turn to the third world countries that they were giving aid to and saying, we're going to build you up and build a prosperous middle class and make you a little bit more like Western Europe or North America so that you will not be tempted to go communist, and which means go socialist. We want to keep you capitalist, but a kind of a capitalism with a human face. Well, capitalism with a human face is now capitalism in your face. And they don't have to do that anymore. They don't have to tolerate even a right-wing nationalist country that has any kind of national, economic nationalism. Let's take Iraq. Now, here's a hidden fact about Iraq. This is a secret fact. It's a secret in America. It's a secret on the U.S. media. It's a secret in all the pundit talk shows. It's a secret among our national official leaders. It's never mentioned. But Saddam Hussein was put in power in Iraq by the CIA. He was sponsored by the U.S. His task was to stop the Iraqi Democratic Revolution. And he did that. He destroyed the Kurdish Democratic Party. He destroyed the Iraqi Communist Party, which was a reformist coalition party, coalition building party. He even slaughtered and executed the left wing of his own Ba'athist Party. He was Washington's boy. They loved him. They gave him aid. They built those chemical and bacteriological factories that he had in Iraq. That's another secret that you're not told. It was the U.S. that not only knew about this CNB warfare, that's come out in the press. It seems certain U.S. leaders knew that Saddam Hussein had chemical and bacteriological weaponry back in during the Iraq-Iran war. They knew about it. Of course they knew about it. They gave it to him. They gave him the technology. That's another secret that's never told. So he was Washington's baby boy. They loved him. Fair-haired boy. Until he got out of line, on oil prices, until he started showing himself to be an economic nationalist. He didn't turn Iraq into a comprador client state and say, come on in, boys, it's all yours, take it, any terms you want, pay them any wages you want, don't worry about anything, no public services, none of that stuff, you take what you want on the terms that are totally favorable to you, just make sure you give me something. He didn't do what leaders did in Turkey and other parts of Africa and Latin America and whatever else. Instead, he became an economic nationalist. He started public education programs. He started public health services. Iraq, before 1991, had the highest standard of living in the Middle East. That was destroyed by a president named George Bush, George the First. All sorts of reasons have been given by U.S. leaders regarding why we must attack Iraq. Many of those same reasons were given under the reign of George the First. When George I decided to attack Iraq, he said, we have to go in because Iraq is threatening to invade Saudi Arabia. That was false. There were no Iraqi troops massing on the Saudi border. Even the U.S. press reported there was no evidence of that. It's got to be pretty blatant when the U.S. press will actually report, too. Then they said, well, we've got to go into Iraq because they're committing these terrible atrocities against the Kuwaitis. They just took 500 Kuwaiti babies, ripped them out of incubators, and threw them on the hospital floors, Iraqi soldiers laughing and ha 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 and bayoneting these babies and all that. And some of us sat there and said, 500 incubators in a country with 3 million people? All of Los Angeles County with 14 million people has about 50 incubators in major public hospitals. Wait a minute, does Iraq specialize in premature babies? What is this? They just happen to have 500 babies? That story too proved to be a total fabrication. Please don't do that. This thing needs it doesn't have it. That story too proved to be a total fabrication. They made all sorts of stories up. There was another reason for going to Iraq. They said, this would create jobs for the economy. I'm not kidding you. Secretary of State at that time under George I, James Baker, said, this war will create jobs. We wanted to get the Americans interested and hyped up about Iraq. And I thought to myself, well, now George I has been in office for 3 years. He has never evinced any interest in creating jobs for Americans before. Isn't this unusual? And I thought, you know, creating jobs, well, you know, child pornography creates jobs. Auto accidents create jobs. Auto accidents are good for the economy. I'm not being funny, I'm not being ironic, I'm being absolutely serious. Auto accidents are a multi-billion dollar industry. The towers, the wreckers, the mechanics, the emergency health clinic workers, the plastic surgeons, the lawyers, you could go, the state troopers, you could go on and on, the police, the jobs that are created by auto mechanics. It's good for the economy. The point I'm making is that there are many things that might be good for the economy that are bad for human beings. Then in November of 1990, the George I government came up with another reason. A poll had just been taken. I don't think it was even sponsored by the government. It was a private poll taken, national survey poll, Roper or one of those groups. And it said, if Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons, would you support a military action against him? And that, for the first time, the lukewarm American public went up and said yes. But even then, by the way, even right on the eve of the war, the U.S. public, by overwhelming majorities, preferred negotiated withdrawal of Iraq from Kuwait and negotiated settlement of the conflict rather than committing U.S. forces to that place. Once the forces are committed, then many of my mindless compatriots get up there and rally around the flag and got to support our troops, they're there now. And the flag happens to be wrapped around the president, and there's this eternal menace and external menace and evil, and so we have to back the president for our own security. And that whole dynamic does kick in. Now that was very interesting, that poll. That was seized on by the Bush administration in 1990 as the reason to go after Iraq. And that is the very same reason that got resuscitated just several months ago, isn't it? Right here by George II. We have to go in because Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. The other reason we have to go in is because, linked to Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein isn't linked to Al-Qaeda. They are orthodox, fanatical Muslims. Hussein was a secularist. He has a secular state. There are mosques in Iraq, and there's prayers, and they're announced, and there's all that stuff. But they don't love that guy. He doesn't have links to Al-Qaeda. The Bush family has more links to the bin Laden family than... Another reason they gave was that Iraq refused to negotiate, George I said. That was false. The Iraqis were eager to negotiate a withdrawal. There was even a French delegation that was making progress. They were working through the French. And that was called the nightmare scenario by the first Bush administration. The nightmare scenario. That is, what if they get out before we can attack them? Because if we can't attack them, then we can't destroy that society. And if we can't destroy it, then we can't get troops stationed permanently in that region more deeply. Well, all these reasons proved false, right? And all the reasons today, I think. I've lost my place in my notes because I've gone beyond what I got here. Just talk to yourselves a minute. Okay. Now you can do one of two things. Oh, let me tell you about non-compliance. I have here the statement made in December 98 by the Iraqi Minister of Foreign Affairs. He said, "Why do they charge us with non-compliance?" In fact, the United Nations brought in inspection teams, and they performed 427 inspections at 427 different sites. 422 of those inspections were proved to be in perfect compliance and cooperation. They charged us, out of 427, they charged us with 5 cases of non-cooperation. 5. These were the cases. One, they wanted to inspect the small headquarters of a political party, the Arabic Socialist Party. We asked them, what is the relationship between small headquarters of a political party and a disarmament mission? They didn't answer. But that 20-minute, 50-minute delay where they questioned, that was called noncompliance. They did go in and investigate the headquarters. The same thing happened with the what had been the office of the Deputy Director of Special Security. They said, or rather the Iraqis said, this headquarters has been converted into a guest house. It's not an official place at all. And they argued with them. The fact that they had taken about 30 minutes or delayed the inspection 30 to 45 minutes, that too was cited as another example of noncompliance. Another example of noncompliance was an American named Diana Simon. She insisted that she could go to Baghdad University and interview all the undergraduate students in the science college. The Iraqis raised questions about that and said that's an unrealistic thing to do. That's incredible. What has that got to do with disarmament? What do undergraduate students have to do with disarmament? You can certainly interview the postgraduates for the master and doctor's degree in science if you think they're involved in any kind of weapons development. This was the level of noncompliance. The UN has also reported that every year since 1998, the Iraqis have been in full compliance with the yearly UN inspection team. I was in Iraq and met UN forces. They were right there in Baghdad, or personnel. I shouldn't say forces, personnel. Well, now at this point, you can do one of two things. You can stop with a liberal complaint and say, all the reasons they've given for wanting to attack Iraq are stupid, are wrong, are false. So aren't they stupid? Aren't they so stupid? That's what you could say. Or you can take a radical analysis. You can make a radical analysis and say, no, look at it in this larger context that I've been trying to give you tonight. They're not stupid. You're stupid if you think they're stupid. You're stupid if you think your enemies are stupid. I know that all of North America is full of liberal intellectuals who love to say how stupid their leaders are. In the U.S., I can tell you, everybody in the U.S., everybody's making jokes about how stupid George Bush is. I tell my fellow countrymen and women, I say, you know, we keep electing these stupid leaders. Does this have any reflection on our intelligence? I thought Canadians would like that joke. You hear this all the time. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time we give less emphasis to how stupid these people supposedly are and give more attention to how vicious and relentless and uncompromising they are. Please. There are, in fact, very compelling reasons why they're targeting Iraq. The fact that they don't tell us those reasons doesn't mean those reasons may not exist. First, there's the one I've just mentioned and talked about, the global strategic reason, which is to make sure that no country gets out of this closed, fixed global system of multinational corporate capital expropriation at terms that are totally favor the global financial investors at the expense of the people. The struggle at that global strategic level is between those people who say that the land, the labor, the natural resources, the markets, the technologies, and the wealth of nations belongs to a few, that they're there for the expropriation and for the further and further enrichment of a few. They're there for the Dick Cheneys who made $260 million last year and it wasn't enough. He wants $360 million this year. They want more and more. Wealth is their addiction. Brothers and sisters, the worst addiction in North America, the most dangerous addiction is wealth. It's not drugs. They got more money. They got more money than they know what to do with. They got more money than they could spend in 20,000 lifetimes. They've got more money and all they want is more and more and more and more of it. They're addicts. They're dangerous, dangerous addicts. And this is what we're fighting against. Now, so there's that global strategic
goal,
which is to get Iraq back in line as an impoverished, broken country, just as they broke Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was another case. Right there in the middle of Europe, a very large country, 80% of its economy was still publicly owned, a standard of living that was still high, with an elaborate system of public services and human services. Now it's been broken up into small right-wing republics. Everything's deregulated. Everything's been privatized. Everybody is poor. They're poor now in Bosnia. They're poor now in Macedonia. They're getting poor in Montenegro and Serbia. Poor, poverty, privatize, deregulate, get them down to being the peasants. Someday, if we try and hope and pray enough, they'll be lining up to work for 15 cents an hour. And they're getting close to that already. So there's that goal of keeping that whole system of capital expropriation. It's between those who say all of that belongs to them and those of us who say all of that belongs to the people and the human communities of this planet. That's the fight between those two. There's a second reason, more immediate particularly, there's the old colonial natural resource oil reason, expropriation of a particular resource. Iraq has a reserve of 45 billion barrels of oil. At $25 US dollars a barrel, that's $1 trillion. That's a lot of money. And not a drop of that oil is owned by the Bush family or Dick Cheney's or Exxon or these guys. It infuriates them. There have been French and Russian concessions made to the French and the Russians. But the U.S. wants to get in there and really grab it all and give the French and the Russians their 8% or whatever. So there's that to be considered also, direct colonial grab. There's a third reason. Just like with George I, there are very compelling issues that have been going on in the United States that have been redounding most unfavorably upon the Bush administration. Back during George I's day, it was the savings and loan scandal, a $1 trillion ripoff by people strategically placed of the public treasure, which U.S. taxpayers will be paying for generations to come. That was getting out in the national media. George I was facing the prospect of maybe two, possibly three of his own sons going to jail. It all got blown right off the front page. It got blown right out of the news once he pursued that war against Iraq. And today, incredibly so, the very same thing is happening. It's the very same issues, not the savings and loan, but it's Exxon and WorldCom and corporations that have been plundering worker pension funds, that have been plundering their own employees, that have been plundering the investor class. It's a very interesting case where capitalism is such a self-devouring beast that it can devour itself. And the state, one of the functions of the state is to advance it's a rather contradictory thing. It's an interesting thing. One of the functions of the capitalist state is to advance the opportunities for devouring and expropriation. Another function it has is to contain that and stop it sometimes when it threatens, when the parasites threaten to destroy the organism upon which they feed. Argentina is a very good example of the failure of the capitalist state to keep the most pernicious, avaricious elements of that class from devouring the entire financial social structure. People's life savings gone up and stolen from them. So you had this happening, and because it was the investor class itself that was getting victimized in the U.S., a lot of this was getting in the press. And it wasn't looking good. It wasn't looking good even personally for Bush and Cheney. Bush with his relationships with Harkins and Cheney with Halliburton, two big corporations, where the same thing was happening. Stock prices artificially pumped up so that the value of their stock could go all the way up. And then with insider trading just before the slide down, they sold it off at incredible, incredible profits and then left everybody else holding worthless paper. Both Bush and Cheney did this. Both of them lied about not knowing anything about it. There's evidence they were in on it. Of course they were. That too, blown right out of the news, right out of the paper. Who's going to talk about George Bush, world leader, world statesman, commander-in-chief, moving to fight the demon Saddam Hussein? Who's going to start talking about Harkin now? This guy belongs in jail, and instead he's elevated himself to king of the planet. The Republican Party was just, which just 2 months ago was the party of big business corporate scandal, big business favoritism, seriously in trouble. The Republican Party is now the party of military strength and military leadership. So this is what we're facing here. The war against Iraq will distract from domestic problems. It justifies increased military spending. It fuels the patriotic hype. It jacks up the president's poll ratings. It diminishes, they hope, the momentum behind dissent. But, you know, it doesn't always work so perfectly. Things have been changing. Things have been developing for the better. There have been real questions raised about this coming war. There's a very real skepticism in the United States about this whole venture. There are people who remember the last one, who got all worked up with it. Let's go, yeah, let's go get them in Iraq. Let's go get Iraq. Let's go kill them. George I's approval ratings in January 1991 were 93% when he bombed Baghdad and killed all those innocent people. 93%, because this was war, as I told you before, these people mindlessly rallying around the flag. Within 10 months, George I, unbeatable, 93%, within 10 months, he had lost re-election for President of the United States to a garrulous governor from Arkansas. What happened? Well, people woke up after the patriotic binge and they said, USA, USA. Hey, you know, this is not paying the rent. USA, USA. You know, this isn't feeding the kids. You know, this isn't getting me a job. What's happening here? Did we get the whole story, or didn't we? There's another difference. That last war, the U.S. was able to corral the capitalist democratic leaders of all sorts of other countries to send troops and to participate. This time, in all these various countries, people are saying no. Germany. Look at Germany. Gerhard Schroeder. Now, Gerhard Schroeder is a slimy right-wing social democrat who will sniff the wind and go anyway, like his dreams. Gerhard Schroeder, 17 points behind during the campaign, emerges and squeaks through and wins because he emerges as a late-blooming peacenik. He says, German troops will not go in any war against Iraq, and he won an election. It was the power of the people registering upon him. Let's take lapdog Tony Blair. I call him the senator from England. Lapdog Tony Blair, who never met a U.S. president whose hand he didn't want to lick. Just a few weeks ago, Tony Blair was saying we're going right down the line. We're going to be in there. We're going to take the action, usual stuff. And then 350,000 Brits demonstrated, you remember? And now Blair has shifted over. Remember? Right. In Italy, Saturday, Has that been reported anywhere? In Italy, 1.5 million Italians demonstrated all over Italy, estimated 1.5 million Italians. The people are aware and the people are moving despite their stupidities, despite the way they can be fooled about things at times. It's amazing. What is amazing is that in the face of this monopoly propaganda that we get in the States, and I think you get a lot of it here in Canada too, in the face of that, we still have people who are questioning and who are wondering. The people of Ecuador, in weeks of civil siege, have forced the government to rescind privatization. There are warrants out in several countries for Pinochet's scalp. At least 3 different countries have warrants out for Henry Kissinger. That's good. There's a struggle going on right now to keep the collective farms in capitalist Russia, to keep them and not give them up. There's land redistribution going on in Brazil, done by the people themselves, seizing the land all through southern Brazil. There have been massive demonstrations all over the world. There have been general strikes. Even in the U.S., demonstrations are beginning. We're beginning to gather momentum on this whole Iraq thing. I was in Marin County just 2 weeks ago. Marin County in California is vintage. It's California essence, you know. And I talked to the organizers there. They said, you know, we have a peace vigil. 10 people show up with candles against the war. And this past week, we got up there, and 150 people came with candles. And the people that kept going by in cars, a constant blasting of their horns. It didn't stop. It's continual blasting of the horns and people giving the thumbs up and cheering, saying, yes, no war, no war. Marin County said, we had a demonstration. We were hoping to get 300 or 400 people, and 2,000 people came out in Marin County. Marin County, I mean, that's hundreds of people who abandoned their hot tubs, who skipped their yoga classes, their meditation sessions. Trudging the hot streets, some of them supplied with nothing more than a granola bar. I mean, the image is, it's inspiring. It's an inspiring, beautiful image, you know. It's moving all the rest of us. Just the other day in Cincinnati, 5,000 people came out in Cincinnati, Ohio. Now, Cincinnati, Ohio is considered part of the U.S. heartland. Some people call it the wasteland, but whatever. I mean, Cincinnati people... That was an unusual figure, and it's just starting. 5,000 people. That's hundreds, you know, leaving their bowling alleys and whatever else and going out there and doing these things. So we have people in motion, and we must inform ourselves. We've got to organize and mobilize. We've got to join with other groups, labor unions, community groups, church groups, professional associations, at all levels. There's no going back to 1900. The future has to be not their future, but our future. Now, and at the same time, we have to, while mobilizing, reaching out to other people, we have to impact on our leaders and let them get the message right, let them know. And let them know that you're not just speaking for yourself, but for many others, that they cannot pursue this kind of course. People sometimes say to me, "Well, what do you have? A conspiracy theory? Do you think these leaders are just deliberately trying to manipulate the whole world just to suit themselves?" What do you say? Conspiracy theorists. How do you like that? I mean, do you think there's actually a group of men sitting in a room who sit there and are plotting these things? For some reason, do you hear that? Do you have that up here? Do you think there's a group of people sitting around in a room? But somehow that image is supposed to be very compelling, you know? So improbable. And I always say, oh, no, they don't sit around in a room. They meet on carousels and they talk to each other that way. Or they do what do they call that? Free falling. No, what do you, with the parachute guys? They all lock arms. You see those parachutes? What? Skydivers. They all skydive. You see them locking arms. What do you think they're talking about when they're all locked arms like that? That's where they meet. Of course they meet in rooms. Where the hell else do you think they're going to meet? They have. Do you have a stochastic theory? There's a word. Look it up. Look it up. Stochasticism is the theory that everything happens by chance. So you have a coincidence theory? Stuff just happens. Oh, George the first wanted to bomb Iraq. George the second wanted to bomb. It just must run in the family. Well, I'm going to end it right here. I'm going to say, you know, in ancient Rome, it was mentioned that I've just written this book called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, People's History of Ancient Rome. Fascinating. I spent 5 years doing it on and off, interrupting it constantly, stealing time from it. But it was a fascinating book. But I think all of these issues, all of these things began in ancient Rome. I don't really believe that, but I'm pushing that line now because of the book. But let me tell you something about ancient Rome. Ancient Rome. There were some notables in ancient Rome who got the idea that slaves, Roman slaves, should get some visible insignia. They should be made to wear whatever it was, a black tunic or some emblem or something, so that slaves could be visible. Because there was a problem with slaves. They mingled in many work sites, you had free labor and slave labor working together, and they would often then, you know, begin to form common sentiments and interests and all that sort of thing. And one of the ways they always tried to distract the plebs, the Roman plebs, the Roman proletariat, was by giving them the fear, spooking them about the slaves. It's a slave, though, the slaves, watch out, you know. Oh, that leader, he's really going to free all the slaves and he'll get you and all that sort of thing. So slaves would often even show up at the forum and shout out at the assembled and all that sort of thing. So they wanted to put the slaves in their place. To put them in their place, they decided they were all going to have to wear a visible uniform of some kind. And then they dropped that idea. Do you know why? Because they realize, they give the slaves this kind of visibility, the slaves themselves will begin to get a sense of their own numbers and strength. Not only will they be visible to us, but they'll be visible to each other. They will find each other. They will see who they are and their numbers. And so we citizens, you know, of whom they would make slaves, and they would, we need to see who we are. We need to see our strength and our numbers, and we just need to see our critical independence of mind and action, for that's what they fear the most, our critical independence of mind and action, and when the people are ready to lead, the leaders will eventually follow. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.